This is the Wheeler Centre podcast.
Hi, everyone. Well done on making it through the late storms this evening. Lovely to have you here for this first question time of the year here at the Wheeler Centre. For those of you who haven't been before, this is a series that we've been running for a couple of years now. And it's essentially an opportunity for the Wheeler Centre to get some people who are really expert in their fields or who have lots of lived experience of certain subjects up here on a stage and to give you open slather to ask them whatever you want in the space of 1 hour. So we've got some more really great subjects coming up this year. Drug policy and harm reduction, the modern family, homelessness, radicalisation, just a few of them. So keep an eye on the Wheeler Centre website to check out what's coming up later in the year. And we're starting off with a cracker tonight, technology and the brain, which I'm sure is something that all of us have thought about, worried about, hoped about in the last couple of years. Just what are these things that we wear, the things that you've got in your handbags, what exactly are they doing to our brains, to our empathy, to our sense of self, to our memory, which is one that I think about a lot, to about our cognition. And for the purposes of tonight, I think that we're going to talk about technology, both in terms of the hardware, but also the software, so the algorithms, the social media, because I think that we tend to lump it all in together, and that's fair enough. Now, of course, throughout history, we've always worried about the effect that technology is having on our brain and on our social structures and on what it means to be human. You know, we were worried about, Plato writes about being worried about the evolution of writing and writing as being a tool which came down to the masses. And, of course, we worried about the printing press and the typewriter. But never before have we seen such a huge amount of exponential change and development in what should be tools for humans or what were always thought of as being tools of humans. And do we really actually understand how that is changing us as human beings, how that is changing us as sentient creatures and what our head does. So we've got two really great experts here this evening to talk to you about that from different fields as well, which is very useful. So Olivia Carter is an Associate Professor and ARC Future Fellow at University of Melbourne School of Psychological Sciences. And Michael Arnold, that's a very big one. Michael Arnold's got just as big a one. He's an Associate Professor and Head of Department in the History and Philosophy of Science program. My name is Madeline Morris. I host the Question Time series here at the Wheeler Centre in my day job. I am a reporter for 7:30. I'm currently on maternity leave, so this is the most people I've seen gathered in one space for quite some time. And I want to give a bit of a welcome to a high school group we've got here from Upway High School. Can you guys put up your hands? You in? Great to see some school students here and making the journey in, so thank you very much. We hope that you come back to more of the Question Times later on this year. So I think the best thing probably to do is just to have you both introduce yourselves and your fields of study and how where you're actually approaching this question of technology in the brain. Olivia?
Sure. So I have a pretty broad interest, but I guess fundamentally I'm interested in how my brain creates me and everything, in, you know, my perceptions, my experiences. I'm particularly interested in the neurotransmitters and how the natural chemicals in the brain impact the way we experience the world. But on a separate side, I'm quite interested in how new developments in neuroscientific knowledge or technologies that change the brain, how that also impacts society, and so the sort of neuroethical sides of that.
Mm. But, and so you're coming from quite a hardware point of view, aren't you?
Yeah, I'm interested very much in, well, is it really, you know, we talk about things changing the brain, is it actually changing the brain or is it just our experiences? So, I'm very much interested in what's happening inside and how the things inside your head impact who we are as people.
And Mike?
Whereas I'm interested in the outside. I don't know anything about what goes on the inside. My writing and research and teaching is concerned with technology in all sorts of daily life contexts. So I've done work on technology in education, social media use in the Asia Pacific and in Australia, technology in general practice and in medicine. And most recently, technology in death and dying, technology in the commemoration of the dead, and new technologies in the disposal of bodies. So my interest in the brain.
Which is, if anyone has a question about that, feel free to ask, but probably not what we were thinking about tonight.
It'll get us right off track. Now, the brain, of course, is, in some views anyway, is very important.
What we'll do is get your questions ready, and we've got two ushers on either side to put your hand up. I can't see you very well from up here, so you're better off trying to wave madly at them, and they'll come and pick you, and they'll do as many from the front as from the back. And do get your questions in early is my tip, because we always have too many at the end. Mike, what were you going to say?
Yeah. But that's a Cartesian view of what it is to be a human. Others would argue that the body is, the body is what we are, and efforts we've made all sorts of efforts over many years to outsource brain function to technologies through artificial intelligence and through lots of other things.
So I'd have to my argument against that would be say I'd be happy to lose legs over my head.
Yeah.
I'm happy to outsource my legs, but I'd be less keen to give up the brain.
And, of course, we do outsource. Every time we drive a motor car, we're outsourcing our legs to the motor car, to the tram, to the aeroplane and so forth. And we're happy to do that, it seems to me, because we do not value the body and body functions as much as we value brain functions. But having said that, there's also desperate efforts to outsource brain functions to technologies.
And what you sent through when we were discussing this online, of course, a little bit earlier during the week, you sent me through some reading which actually sort of questions the very notion of the fact that humans create technology and we are masters of that technology and it doesn't influence us. Tell us about that.
Yes, there's a view that human beings are in charge. It's a very humanist, very human-centred view. And what it suggests is that we're pretty weak in our naked sense. We're not very capable and are very competent as naked apes. But through devising tools and devising technologies, we are able to act in the world in powerful ways. Now, that is true. Through developing these technologies, we are able to do all sorts of stuff, quite obviously. I'll tell a story. People might have, many of you would have seen 2001, A Space Odyssey. You might recall that very moving and powerful scene where, near the start of the movie, where a pre-human picks up an animal thigh bone and plays with the thigh bone as you would, and then either by happenstance...
As you would.
And then either by happenstance or by accident, smacks the thigh bone on the skull of a dead animal sitting nearby, and the skull cracks open. A eureka moment. A very important moment in human history where an object is taken from nature and is transformed into a technology. A technology which is a powerful technology. But that transformation of thigh bone into club is not, in my view, the most important transformation. The most important transformation is not the way the pre-human transforms the thigh bone, but the way the thigh bone transforms the pre-human into a killer. And that is the case with all kinds of technologies, it seems to me, including technologies that don't simply transform our limbs, but technologies that transform the functioning of the mind and brain.
Another good example of that from a piece that I read was about the clock, when the clock first came into common usage in around about, I think it was the 14th century or so, we went away from using our senses to tell us when it was time to eat, when it was time to sleep, when it was time to work. We were suddenly dictated by this external machine. And we now have, of course, all adapted to that.
Yeah.
So did you have a point on Mike's there, and then we'll take some questions?
Well, I'm a little bit maybe fatalist. I know it's the right word, but this feeling that we just are, we go through our world and our brains learn what is around them, and by definition our environments impact who we become, you know, trauma or whatever.
The brain's always changing.
It's always changing, but there's a real difference often in these types of discussions about, oh, you know, I was once, many years ago, when the project, the seven, you know, the Channel 10 or whatever show, the project, I was interviewed, oh, what's happening if we've got all this digital stuff, apparently gigabytes of information our brains are being exposed to, are our brains going to explode or something like this, I was asked. It's like, we just forget, you know, we don't explode, we just don't remember when it's too much information. So, you know, this feeling...
And we've outsourced our memory in a lot of ways.
Yeah, but that's the thing.
But the actual, if you were to say, how many units of information do we remember now versus how many units of information did we remember when we were, you know, wandering around the savannas in Africa? Well, we would understand very different information, but it's utterly not clear from the science whether we're retaining less now. It's different, but this idea, that there seems to be this feeling, is because we're outsourcing this stuff, we know different information that we couldn't have learnt before if we spent all of our childhood learning how to build fires out of sticks and navigating by the stars. That would be bloody hard, or I shouldn't say. So I would say what we're learning is very different, but are we becoming dumber somehow, or is our capacity to absorb new information different?
But we are becoming more forgetful as more information comes to us.
Well, you might remember the latest tweet from Donald Trump and forget your child's phone number.
Okay. Or forget your child.
That is different to saying you're actually becoming more forgetful. You're remembering different information, and possibly because we're exposed to more things, we're encoding things with less detail. Mm. But I don't think the evidence is out there that we're dumber.
Okay.
The capacity to outsource memories, so much greater. You mentioned before Plato being worried about writing in conditions in a written culture as opposed to an oral culture, memory wouldn't be as important. And I think that's true. And we've moved now past writing to all sorts of digital devices that do our so much of cognitive grunt work for us. You know, math students who can't calculate, English students who can't spell, none of us who can remember our family's phone numbers. You know, all of that is outsourced. Now, does this mean we are dumber? I don't know. It's really hard because we can't separate us from the thigh bone. You know, we are technologically enabled. We are cyborgs. We have been for, you know, a long, long time. So,
all right, let's take some questions. What have we got?
I guess I'll kick it off. My name's Alex. I initially had one question, but subsequently through the conversation it sort of evolved. You mentioned with the thigh bone and basically taking that and hitting a skull over the head and the changes, I guess, in the human mindset with, let's say, robotics initially. We were able to start outsourcing physical tasks. Now with
just lift the mic up a wee bit, Alex, if you can.
With the outsourcing of physical tasks in manufacturing and such, now that we're really progressing to artificial intelligence, and I guess the initial step would be the likes of IBM's Watson program, do you think we'll get to a point where some of the more research and psychological tasks will be undertaken by computers? And at that point, what place does that really have for humans in the world?
That's the big question, isn't it, facing all of us?
Before you lose the microphone, can I ask what do you mean by other psychological tasks will be outsourced by computers? Like,
well, with the IBM technology Watson, it's basically you're putting in a lot of data, a lot of information, and it's able to start to draw correlations that would take the human mind many, many thousands, tens of thousands, hundreds of thousands of years to draw that sort of correlations. They're looking at doing that sort of thing with legal documentation. So rather than having a series of lawyers look through various reports and say, hey, look, there's a precedent for this, 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 they'll be able to use these early forms of artificial intelligence to draw those calculations before a human's even needed.
Okay, so I have a response to that. If that's,
yeah.
So I'm glad I asked the question because I think those two examples you gave really highlight the point is that these computers are doing things that would take a human being possibly lifetimes to find patterns and things. And that, so these sorts of algorithms are identifying new information, okay, but they're not, in general at the moment, they're not that good at doing the sorts of things that humans are good at. Like, at the moment, there isn't a person that's employed in a law firm that's spending a lifetime going through legal documents, finding small patterns and correlations. And similarly, I think in medicine, it's huge at the moment, you know, to find novel correlations because our brains are very good at finding averages, okay, but not these little anomalies and these weird patterns that you might find that if you have this particular gene and that blood type and eat this diet, well, you're going to have 10% more chance of getting a heart attack. There's probably no human doctor around that could make those connections just through their personal practice. Now, that doesn't mean what they're currently providing as a doctor is going to be less valued. So to me, it's a really... I'm not at all concerned that the sorts of things people are good at. I mean, things like education, we're very good at communicating with each other. The types of apps that are coming out are generally being found not to be particularly helpful to teaching a 6-year, you know, a 12-year-old how to do maths, you know. So there are things that we're gaining, but at the moment it's not at all clear to me that those things are taking away current skill sets from humans.
So it's a bit of a question, slightly different question from what is actually happening to the brain, isn't it? Sort of how what the usurpment of the brain in certain functions is going to actually do to us as humans, but it's very related to the brain because it's our brain function
and
that's
what
being
we used. What we use our brain for as opposed to outsourcing.
Yeah.
The first cab off the rank would be programmatic tasks, as Turing described a long time ago in his thesis, anything that can be precisely defined can be performed by a computer. And we often think that some forms of white collar work, you know, they're intellectual tasks and won't be touched. But I would have thought things like accounting and bookkeeping, they are programmatic, and I can't see a future for that kind of work.
I mean, this is a slightly more philosophical question, but so much of who we are as human beings, our sense of worth derives from our work and what we do to be productive. And psychologists will tell you that till the cows come home. Mm. So if we now have less work or less, does that mean that we're going to find more work?
No.
Does that mean that we're going to do different things, or are we just going to have less of a sense of ourselves?
We will watch more cute cat videos. I think
is that going to give us a good sense of worth,
pretty,
though?
Pretty clear. I discuss this with my students quite a bit. There's a guy named Borgman who writes about the way technologies disburden us. And he uses the analogy of a wood-burning stove, where when one uses the wood-burning stove, one needs to do a lot of work. You're burdened. You've got to engage with chopping the wood. You've got to engage with carting the wood. You've got to engage with telling the difference between different kinds of wood. You've got to engage with kindling and then big logs. You've got to engage with whether you're going to put more wood on the fire or not put more wood on the fire and save it up for next day. If you're as old as me, you've got to engage with young people who are strong enough to carry the wood for you because you can't split it, and so on and so forth. Alternatively, we can push a button and have heat. So what is that technology doing to us? Do we want to be do we want to be disburdened in the way pushing the button does it? And my students, they all say, yeah, of course, it's crazy having wooden, you know, wood-burning stoves. Sure, we want to push the button. In order to do what, I say? Mm. Oh, well, we write poetry, play music. I don't think so. I don't think so. That is not what people do with the time they have on their hands, having been disburdened by more and more technologies, which mean that people are engaging less and less and doing less and less and making fewer and fewer decisions and ultimately living less and less.
Because our life is the collective of our experiences, some of which are the things that we actually do for ourselves, which provide us with satisfaction.
Yeah, well, consider the way a driverless car disburdens us from driving. We are disengaged from driving. Now, for a lot of people, that's fantastic because they don't like driving. But for a lot of people too, driving is one of these mundane everyday tasks that is living.
I suppose that cooking is something. I mean, there have been we can all buy a ready-made meal, can't we? But so many of us continue to cook because for health reasons, but also because of the pleasure that it gives us.
Exactly, yeah. Mm. And in the philosophy of technology.
But I don't want to do long division for my maths problems.
You'd rather have a calculator do that, yeah. Mm.
So can I? So I'm going to take exception to this, if you know. Because I guess maybe I'm coming at it from a different perspective. You talk about cooking and, you know, you've got all the cooking shows and probably people today presumably have nicer pots and pans than they did 100 years ago. They probably have heating on and they aren't running out the back door to chop wood. But I'm not sure that the person that's enjoying cooking a meal today is having less of a valid experience or somehow a less lived experience than the person 100 years ago. I mean, we're talking about we get fulfilment from your job. It's true, but, you know, in a different generation, in a different country, we weren't doing the jobs we were doing now. And reality, if you take it step back, I mean, I don't want to sound like I normally view the world like this, but effectively, if you believe in evolution, what we do is we're social organisms that find partners and build families, you know, and become experts in things, and we find fulfilment in those things. I almost flip it the other way and think it's remarkable how people find meaning in, actually, if you think about it, it's hard to know where that's coming. So, for example, how many Twitter followers do I have? You know, I don't have a Twitter account, but people care about that stuff. They talk to their friends.
Have a Twitter account?
No, is this problematic?
So you haven't experienced the addiction that is Twitter?
I have a Twitter account, and then I got bombarded after the 3 days of just getting these BBC alerts of something happened in, you know, Africa. And I was
your brain felt overburdened?
No, I just felt like this was not a good use of my time.
Right, yeah. So that's good that you were actually able to make that decision, though, but there are people who can't make that decision because they do genuinely get properly addicted to those things, and I would actually put myself into that category, you know. I feel like the amount of time... And who hasn't sat there at, like, 10:30 at night on Facebook going, I've really got to go to bed because I've really got to get up tomorrow morning, but I'll just go and see what that person did. Who's done that?
Yeah.
Oh, you are all lying if you are saying that you are not doing that. And that kind of brings me to that addiction thing, which is one of the big things which we talk about in terms of technology.
Yeah, so that is one thing that I do think is different. So not so much the content. As I said, our brains learn the things that we're exposed to, but I do think the way that the brain learns from its environment is, I guess, it puts more emphasis on reliable information, I guess. If you do X and you get a reward straight away every time, well, you may as well do that thing again as opposed to some other thing that has a lower likelihood or lower expectation that you'll get the expected outcome. I mean, in really sort of simple terms, often when you drill down, the brain uses these sorts of simple okay, if on average that was a positive experience, let's do that again, more than the thing that on average was less positive. And I do think one thing that's changing with the digital media and the sort of iPads, that ability to control the outcome, this is actually gets into the sorts of things I know you're interested in, is that you unlike, I'd argue with my children that, look, I don't mind if you spend half an hour watching cartoons on the TV, but to me it's really quite different the way they engage when 3 minutes after their cartoons change, they can push another button and instantly get exactly the episode. You know, my two-year-old demands the particular episode of Thomas the Tank Engine he wants to watch. Mm. It has to have, you know, this train in it, and if I push that button, I'll get it. And just even watching them, I mean, there's neuroscience behind this, but the extraction of that, the reward loop that goes round and round, you hit the dopamine, you get the reward, this is good, to pull that away is a different sort of engagement. Regardless of the content, that capacity to have, just to turn it on with instant gratification with 100% success rate.
And it's that instant gratification, isn't it, which then becomes the issue, because if we expect that in other areas of our life as well.
Well, and also the instant gratification is exactly how the brain learns. If things can happen with a certain probability, you know, like a pokey machine or whatever, but also there's probability in time. So if it's always an immediate, that's the strongest signal for your brain.
So what is happening to your two-year-old's brain, and how do you, and my five-year-old's brain, because she will do exactly the same thing, what is happening to her brain, and how is that going to affect her brain in 15 years' time?
So I don't think it's necessarily going to change the brain in 15 years' time, but I do think the capacity to extract yourself from this highly rewarding situation, it turns an otherwise sort of passive experience, still enjoyable. You might very much enjoy a show. Like if you turned up to a theatre, you might enjoy the show, but no part of you is thinking, well, I'm going to replay that, you know. The actors can all come back. That's not part of the experience. So I think it's just, it makes it harder to extract yourself. And I honestly don't think 15 years later that's going to have a huge impact. But this capacity to just break away and you get sucked in and you sort of have to, is mildly addicted to all these things around you, makes things harder.
People like Mark Zuckerberg and his team are very good at what they do. Mm. They're very good at attracting eyeballs and holding eyeballs. They're probably not as good as poker machine manufacturer who for 20 or 30 years have employed the best psychologists in the world to make their machines addictive. Mm. And they've certainly succeeded in that. Facebook don't do a bad job either. YouTube, as you were suggesting, YouTube do a good job as well.
And then there are the ethics of that, which we could go into, and sort of the ethics of technologists and whether they actually think about the ethics of the things that they're creating. You know, if you work in the medical field and you want to design a three-parent baby, as we've seen in the last year or so, for want of a better term, you have to go through a rigorous ethics procedure for that, yet none of the technology which could be impacting our lives in a very profound way has to actually go through any of that kind of rigorous testing.
Yeah. No, I mean, I've written papers about the fact that not only you talk about just media, Facebook and the like, you can buy brain stimulators that send electrical current through your scalp, and they have gone through no safety testing beyond what you would put a toaster through. Okay, they have to prove that it won't sort of self-combust as a technological device, but they don't have to prove in any way that the current that it's sending is what it says it's sending, or that would be a positive thing for your brain. So that's the more issue. I mean, I'm quite interested in that side of things. But
why would anyone want a brain stimulator?
Well, there's all sorts of people out there saying that it helps them concentrate.
Where the device is controlled.
This is a bit of a rabbit hole, but this is actually really fascinating.
You wear a skull cap and you think, and you can control devices by thinking.
Yeah.
There is a whole world out there that I know nothing about. Who would like to ask another question?
I've heard that reading and writing has changed the memory ability of humankind. Once people would memorise long poems, sagas, much longer than one person's part in a play. Is it true that once upon a time people could remember larger, longer bodies of work, and that reading and writing has changed not just a few individuals, but has changed mankind, humankind's ability to memorise large amounts of stuff by being able to read it rather than having to memorise it? And do we have anything to learn if it is true that that did happen 1,000 years ago? Is there anything that we've got to learn from that now?
Poetry was, as I understand it, poetry was devised in part as a memory aid, the rhythms and the rhymes, and certainly in a pre-literate culture, the capacity to memorise very large slabs of text was very highly valued. Still is today. In Muslim communities, the ability to memorise the Quran and to be able to accurately recall the Quran is valued, and people do manage to do it. But there is, as I understand it, there is also evidence that we are doing that concentration spans are not as they were. So, for example, in reading, physiological work that shine infrared lights into people's eyes in order to see where their eyes are moving across the screen, see that it's not a linear start at the top, go across, and, you know, read sentence by sentence, paragraph by paragraph, page by page. There's a snatch on the screen. There is a snatch and grab eye movement. And, of course, Mark Zuckerberg and many others who design websites know about this, and they use different sized fonts and bold fonts on keywords and key phrases, and people move quickly and snatch and grab. Again, anecdotal evidence from my students. When was the last time you sat with a book and read for an hour without the hyperstimulation of colour, movement, sound, multiple screens, you know, being open at the same time?
Can I ask that of the audience? Who has read, let's say, half an hour? Let's make it easy. Who's read a book for half an hour in the last month? I have.
Yeah.
You? Have you both done that?
I've read things for half an hour, but not a lot of fiction at the moment.
Yeah. So is that because we're all older and will our daughters, our children be able to do that?
It's really difficult to separate out those variables. There are differences in the way people perform and behave according to their screen use. Yeah. So people who multitask routinely, for example, perform differently to people who do not multitask. But the chicken and egg is really difficult there to sort out, whether it's something about their personality or cognition or whatever that predates multitasking and leads to the proclivity to multitask, which leads to a decline in performance, or whether it's the multi-screen multitasking that leads to changes in performance is difficult to sort out. And then you've got, you know, correlations that are made between screen time and performance. How do you factor in their different parenting styles, where it may well be that kids who've grown up with lesser screen time have lesser screen time because the parents are parenting in a different way to those who are having more screen time. So is it the screen time or is it the parenting? Yeah. There's these kinds of things that are really difficult to sort out.
Yeah, so I would agree with that. Certainly in the I don't think there's a lot of strong evidence one way or the other in terms of what is the clear impact of these different, parenting styles and all the rest of it. But if you go back and you just think, right, well, effectively our brains are born, and this nutrition's changing, but, you know, an infant comes into the world fairly much with a similar sort of brain as it did generations ago. And it's learning from its environment. So if I do think you learn skills in, for example, imaginary play, Okay, if you're learning those skills, if you're bored and you've got your next door neighbour and your little brother to play with and nothing else, well, you start playing games. And you remember last time we had some funny game hiding in the bush, that was fun, let's do that again, you know. So as a, that's what we do, and we become expert in those things. So I would completely disagree, but there's no science, no one's done this study, that we've lost the capacity, like the 20-year-old, the generation of 20-year-olds or whoever, whichever generation, has lost the ability to learn long texts. I mean, you look at, I was thinking, the you know, Buddhist monks, that's in some values, in some cultures, that's highly valued still in some positions, and I would dispute that a monk today has a noticeably harder time than a monk a generation before. Now, whether a kid in our society that's growing up, and even things like, as a student, we've got some students here, you normally, if you're sitting exams, they normally make a point, the teachers, you have practice exams, and that's partly because you learn to sit there, and there's a certain way of engaging. And I do think that there are those sorts of skill sets that can be developed, in the capacity to just sit. I mean, I do a lot of very boring tasks that are sort of testing vision. My husband will attest to this. You sit there in front of a computer screen pushing, did it go beep? Did you see a light? Push a button if you did. And that for an hour and a half, people are doing these things. It's really boring. And we get very different results from just the average person off the street versus the third year undergraduate student. Because the third year undergraduate student is used to just saying, right, well, I for course credit, I have to sit here for an hour and push this button. And they're kind of practiced at just sitting still and remember, you know, doing some relatively boring task. So I do think that there is these higher level skills that we can generate, you know, but that I don't think it's the case that we're losing these fundamental capacities of human processing. The comment, I mean,
On a physiological sense, but certainly in a learnt ability sense.
Well, it depends. It's sort of the comment before, it can be taken either way. Is our ability to remember text changing? Is the ability to remember these
ability
changing?
But
the motivation has changed.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. The motivation has changed, and the daily, you know, performance in daily life has changed.
So the human brain is fundamentally the same.
Yeah, but if
as it was.
But if tomorrow, I guess the question is, if tomorrow you changed your motivations, if tomorrow you decided you want to sit down and read a book for an hour, I would suggest you'd probably be able to do that.
So we'll take the next question just a moment, but we've heard a lot about sort of wearable tech, and one of the things was Google Glass, which I don't actually exist anymore. I think it was a bit of a failure. But I read this quote from Sergey Brin of Google, and he said 10 years ago, certainly if you had all the world's information directly attached to your brain or an artificial brain that was smarter than your brain, you'd be better off. Now, there are lots of things to dissect in that statement, but one of them is if you had something attached to your brain which had all of the world's information, could your brain handle that? What would your brain do with that? Would it forget, as you said it would? I mean, does our brain have extra capacity to be able to hold that? You know, what from on a fundamentally sort of physiological level, can you answer that question?
Well, I would say, I mean, I don't really understand exactly. If effectively saying, he's there saying you could outsource everything, we'd be very bored. I think we'd quite quickly, what we'd find is some bizarre capacity. We're very driven organisms to competitive, so we'd find some ridiculous.
Is that hardwired in us?
I think it is.
Right.
You know, I mean, other people would disagree, but we'd find some ridiculous way to be better than the other person that was also had this. We'd probably go out and spend all our energy trying to find points like the Pokemon thing. We'd create some virtual thing to get more information into this artificial thing attached to a head. I don't know. I mean, this is now, it's quite a ridiculous sort of.
It's come up in a policy sense. At the moment, it doesn't exist as in plug it in the back behind your ear, but it does exist in terms of being able to access the internet.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And the policy sense in which it's come up is with teaching science in schools, and what do you do about that balance between kids knowing stuff and kids being able to find out stuff? And it, back when I was a school teacher 20 years ago, the view then was very much that we were in the business of teaching kids to find out stuff, not to know stuff. Now, the pendulum has swung the other way, it seems to me, and certainly science educators are saying it's very important that kids know stuff, not just be able to find it out.
So
the outsourcing to the internet, it's not enough to be able to use Google and to be able to use Wikipedia to find out, you know.
So I suppose my question following on from that Sergey Brin quote is that, you know, I'm sure that I've read places, and you all would have read them as well, that, you know, our brain only uses 10% of its capacity. And so if we have something either hardwired into here, or we have stuff hardwired here, which we can, by some miracle, do an instant search the second our brain thinks of it and goes on, and we find the answer written up on our glasses, is the brain able to cope with that or thrive, or how would the brain respond to that?
Yes. Can I change the question slightly? Because I'd actually not... I have not really heard people talking about that in a tangible... Well, maybe how that just in a separate computer attaches straight into your head. Not too sure. But what I have read, you know, the serious discussion out there that I find hard to get my own head around is the idea... So there's two classes of people. This feeling that we're being outpaced by technology... Okay, so not in the case that you're talking about in terms of we're all happily as we are, but how about we just attach this thing to us? There is, particularly there's this hub in Silicon Valley where there's a lot of, you know, tech billionaires, and there's also a lot of neuroscience going on there, and there's a lot of people talking. And there are people, I've spoken to people that have been in meetings where like these billionaires are funding research into ways that they can... Basically, they're funding their own private scientists. This is actually happening. So that they can outpace the artificial world around them. So there's this Elon Musk who's, you know, Tesla fame and now being in all the media all the time. He's genuinely, seriously writing these papers about maybe we're all stuck in this simulated world, and he and other billionaires are paying computer programmers to try and hack themselves out of the simulation just in case they're in one. It's crazy. And there's other people, so I don't know the name of this particular person, but I know for a fact there's someone that's hired a full-time neuroscientist and put in millions of dollars into... with Parkinson's disease and these types of things, they are, you know, stimulating brain regions to increase dopamine release, and that's all fine. But there's also efforts to stimulate directly into the parts of the brain that code memories. So there the point is, well, if we could remember more, not to outsource, not to just have a box where it sits there, what about if we could just have a box that detects the world around us, because those boxes exist. We've got artificial systems that... And then to feed them directly in so it becomes part of the real experience, you know, as opposed to just it sort of hovers. And that if we're forgetting, it doesn't matter, because they'll just stimulate the memory bit. Now, the where we are in terms of understanding brain function and that is so far away. But that people are talking... In those areas, I find mind-boggling this idea that we're going to be overtaken by technology. I mean, I don't have a sort of conclusion to that, but people are taking those things seriously, and money is being invested in these ways,
which sounds terrifying to me.
It sounds half terrifying, half insane to me. But
Okay, next question, please. Do get your hands up so the ushers can go around and signal to me. They'll signal to me when we've got questions. We'll try and get through a few because we haven't got much time left.
Two questions related. One is, are we losing our capacity to have intrinsic rewards. And the other one is with regard to autonomy. I work in health services and we have to actually write everything down, and that goes into algorithms, or if it doesn't now, will, which will determine how we function in our day-to-day work environment. And I should imagine that would become fairly widespread in other industries. So I just wonder about the intrinsic rewards and the autonomy.
By intrinsic rewards, you mean feeling good about something that you've done yourself?
That's right. Having the capacity to spend time doing something in an autonomous way, so you're not relying on those the soft extrinsic rewards mm-hmm. that you get on games and what have you, mm-hmm. and those hard extrinsic rewards.
Mm. I guess what some philosophers of technology would say there is that we need to be prepared to make judgments about technology, not simply accept that high technology is good and low technology is not good, and that version 2.1 is better than version 2, etc. So actually make a judgment about whether to deploy this technology in your life or in your workplace or not. And that in itself is a big step for a lot of people.
So just to that intrinsic reward question, I mean, is there evidence along those lines? Have there been studies done into that about whether people have lost the capacity to generate their own happiness from within, or whether it needs to come from without?
We know that people do get, and you gave examples yourself, of people who use focal practices or focal technologies, as they're called, for the intrinsic reward of doing things, of being engaged, of being burdened with things like playing the piano. Mm. I can buy a CD or I can download the best piano playing in the world, but it's no substitute for playing the piano yourself. It's no going out to a restaurant is all very fine. I like doing that, but it's no substitute for cooking. So this is. The position that's put is to say, yes, let's have technological development, let's have innovation, let's continue this journey we've been on for thousands of years, but let's, for goodness sake, make some judgments about what technologies enable us to live more, what technologies are intrinsically rewarding, you know, such as a copper saucepan, you know. Yes, we'll say yes to the copper saucepan, and we'll say no to what used to be called a TV dinner. I don't know what they're called now, mm-hmm. but you'll know what I mean. Mm-hmm.
So I might jump to answering the second question, because I actually think, I mean, I haven't spent too much time thinking about it in detail, but that issue of autonomy to me is actually really interesting. I mean, I don't have. Particularly, there are all sorts of concerns about privacy that is separate to that, but there is part in terms of the way we engage in the world, if we're just thinking from the very purely biological perspective and not the larger sociological sort of version of this, it is known one of the best ways or most reliable ways to induce stress in a person is this feeling of lack of control. So if the way we work, if so much of our lives is sort of plugged in to systems of things like email coming all the time, or the inability to disengage. It's not to say, in the past what we've been talking about here is to say, are we getting better and worse at disengaging? And I think to the extent that we are in control of the decisions, then they're just different decisions, you know. But when we lose control to disengage, when we actually can't get away from the boss knowing where we are and be contactable at, you know, 3 o'clock on a Sunday afternoon, well, that itself actually puts you in a different sort of framework. And I do think that that's a different sort of conversation, where that type of technology or... It's a bit different, but if you can't control... People often talk about being bombarded by images of horrible scenes around the world news and all the rest of it. Now, it's already bad, but if you can't... There's no way to extract yourself from that, because there's just always TV on and everywhere you look, you're getting this. So I do think that that is starting to change with the way technology is getting to every part of our lives, as we... is an element where you lose control of that. And if you actually are losing control, that becomes quite a stressful sort of situation.
Mm-hmm. Okay, let's take another question, please.
Hi, I'm Kate. Just a question probably ties a little bit back to what Alex raised initially, where, you know, correlation doesn't necessarily equal causation. And with these technologies, a lot of it is to do with data and the quality of the import of data. And then, of course, there's the interpretation of that data that goes with it. And, you know, recently there's been these wonderful headlines in the States how criminals should be fearful of this new algorithm that's going to get rid of all the crime in the world. But the reality is it's the quality of the data that goes into the system and then the interpretation of that data that is questionable. And I guess I would say the human experience is really what enables that interpretation, as opposed to an algorithm that's been put in also by another human. Another interesting side conversation to have. But I guess the question that I have for the panel today is, in that sense of whether it's behaviourally or physiologically, when we're relying more on these sorts of technologies and the way that then potentially can manipulate our interpretation of the data, where potentially could that lead us in the future in terms of future generations and their understanding to look for the source as opposed to accept what they've been told or given with this...
That's a very meta question.
It comes back to that loop in terms of they're sitting on YouTube, they're watching it, they can play it over and over again. They're not living that experience, they're seeing it through somebody else's eyes. Mm. And therefore, the question I have is in terms of the data that spits out of a particular system that says X, Y, and Z, how do we develop in terms of interpreting that data?
So one, a quick question if we can, because I'd like to get to one more question.
Okay, so one thing I would just say, I don't know if it exactly answers that question because it was quite a complex question, but I do think that one of these tricks, I think it's worth sort of being aware of, that the brain uses to survive in this complex world that we're in which a lot of the information that we're exposed to just washes over us. But there is absolutely the case that one trick across evolution is that if something is happening with greater frequency, it's sort of more believable, as it were, okay? So that's fine if you're trying to find, well, the red fruit. If you eat the berry when it's red, you're going to get a sore tummy because the last four times you did that, that's true. And if, you know, so that sort of rules. Now, again, that's how our brain has evolved. So if when we're looking on the internet or searching on YouTube, in this world of the kind of post-truth sort of, you know, reality, whatever this is that if what we're encountering in a way that our brains in a dumb system would consider semi-random is not remotely random, well, that we're not learning, we haven't been taught or evolved to be super sceptical of that, okay? If you click on 5-10 different sources and they all say the same thing and they all happen to be tapping into the same Fox News network, well, that makes it more real in our brains. And I do think that's something we're going to have to start teaching students to say, you're going to have to fight that, because we've evolved in a world where we can trust. If you've encountered the thing 10 times in a row, it's probably true. Well, you can't trust that, and that's something we're going to have to learn, be aware of, I think.
That's very interesting. Okay. If you don't mind, Mike, I'll just take another question.
Hi. I'm Bonnie. I'm with the Upway High Kids. And you guys have touched on almost all of the areas of study we do in VCE philosophy. And so my mind is racking for which of the questions could I ask that would help these guys the most.
But are you philosophy students, are
yes,
you?
Yes.
Oh, great.
Yep. And I guess I'm interested in maybe the ethical implications, and some of it has come up, like whether technology makes us dumber or whether we could outsource moral decision making to a robot, those kinds of ethical implications. To what extent does technology impact on consciousness?
Pick one.
Yeah, I don't know which one. I mean, will technology make us happier, I guess, would sum up a fair chunk of what we study. Yeah.
That's a good place to end as well. We'll let the philosopher answer.
Technology will make us happier if we choose technologies that enable us to live more.
Do we have evidence?
To engage more.
Do we have evidence that that's what we're doing currently?
No. This is a philosophical point. Which brings me to the second point here, which pertains exactly there to your suggestion. Your suggestion is that there is some sort of calculation that we can perform which indicates whether we're going to be happier or not. Now, in a technological world, and this comes back also to the question asked before, in a technological life, calculation trumps judgment. Yeah, do we want to live like that?
Sorry, I'm just thinking about that. I'm sort of calculating in my brain. I haven't come back to a satisfactory answer.
And I guess I would say, to the extent that you control your technology, will technology make you happier? There's all sorts of things out there, whether it's some new cooking gadget, whatever, you know, that absolutely allows you to engage more with the world.
Yeah.
And there are other things that are just completely...
That send you back to the cat videos.
Yeah, exactly.
So exactly. Make the judgment. On the ethical question, that perks my interest. I take a really hard line on this. I think it's not just the Zuckerbergs, et cetera, who need to make ethical judgments about the technologies that they design and make available, but I think that technologies in and of themselves can and should be held to moral account. Not just the people who make them or use them,
mm-hmm.
but the technologies themselves.
Mm. We just don't have anyone to do that at this point in time, other than mum and dad sitting down with the kid deciding whether she's allowed to watch Thomas the Tank Engine for the 10th time.
It's done in exceptional circumstances. Phosphorus bombs, for example, in and of themselves are regarded as unacceptable. Battery cages for hands.
So one thing on the battery cage, you know, that I'm interested in consciousness. One thing I do in neuroscience, and it was one of the major international conferences, you know, the neuroscience of consciousness had an entire session devoted to robot consciousness. And that's not a new thing. That's not okay. Can we have conscious robots? The entire session of this international conference was, if we create conscious robots, we've just deferred the problem, then we have to have a full-blown ethics and morality for the conscious robots that we've created. You know, this does not solve our problem, it defers our problem. And that they're really taking this really seriously, some of the top philosophers of the mind, thinking about, okay, how are we going to defend the rights of robots if we succeed in this objective, which... I had actually never stopped to think about it, but it was very interesting that people are actually thinking about it, which is true. If you succeed, well, what have you created?
Yeah.
You know?
We don't need to get to a fully conscious AI. We do build morality into automatic pilot systems in commercial jets. For example, there's I think it's called...
Into a mountain? Is that what the...
It's intrinsic in their design that they will not go into a vertical dive, you know, for example's sake.
So I don't know if we've answered any of the questions tonight, actually, because every question just presents another 10 more questions, really, doesn't it, in this sort of evolving world of technology, and I think probably none of us really have the answers because it's happening all so fast, and it's happening faster than we can keep up with. Is that right?
Yeah, and it's really hard to do a control experiment of the two-year-old that doesn't have an iPad choosing Thomas the Tank Engine over and over again. You know, it's possibly going to be, you know, impossible to really understand. Really know.
We're learning as we're going, effectively.
Exactly.
We are our own test subjects.
Yeah, exactly.
Okay. Does anyone else want to go and live in Pennsylvania with the Amish? Because that's what I've thought of. I thought about doing that after my daughter's cybersecurity information evening the other night. I thought, this is all just too hard. I'm just going to pack it in and move to Pennsylvania. But look, thank you so much for all of your questions tonight. And it's such a broad topic, and I hope that we've answered some of them tonight and have given you more things to think about and to go away with and to do some more research on and to talk about on Facebook with your friends when you go home and you're meant to be going to bed at 10 o'clock tonight. Could I just ask you all to thank Olivia Carter and Michael Arnold tonight?
Thanks for listening to the Wheeler Centre podcast. don't forget to visit wheelercentre.com for the best in books, writing and ideas from Melbourne, Australia and the world.